Solitaire Rose Radio, episode 47, interview with Devil's Due publisher, creator, writer, Josh Blaylock, part 2. In this second episode, Josh gets into more about Mercy Sparks, which was the Kickstarter he came on to promote. I am not one of those people who feels that someone promoting something in an interview is something bad. When I watch The Tonight Show or Stephen Colbert's show or any other talk show, the reason people go on is they're there to promote something. That's why you go on these shows. I would love if every interview I ever heard anywhere was someone just coming on because they wanted to chat, but that's not the way the world works. People come on because they have something to promote, and when I look for interviews, a lot of the people I have on are people who are either promoting something or someone I know who has a very interesting story. Josh had something to promote. We have a really good conversation. We find out more in this episode, not just about Mercy Sparks, but how his company does their marketing. We dig into First Publishing, because Devil's Due has partnered with First Publishing. We find out about their history and why they have come back. There's a lot of information about comic conventions and marketing at conventions. One of the things I really liked about this conversation was that Josh got into what it takes to sell comics. And it's one of the things that, because of all the retail work I've done in the comic book field, I've always had that in my mind that you can't just drop your books on the market and hope that they get picked up. You got to market, you got to go out, you got to shake hands. And Josh is really good at that. I first met him at one of our conventions, well, either a fall con or a spring con. I don't remember which one because it was quite a while ago. And I was not really into the licensed books that he sold, but he was so engaging and such a good seller that I picked up some of the other stuff they did. He talks about how the marketplace is changing and how he is moving his company in ways to pick up on those winds of change, to kind of sail on them. There's a lot of information here, a lot of good discussion. I really like this episode, and I hope you will too.
Mercy Sparks is everything that I thought I would want to put in a comic book if I had to draw it and keep it fun and entertaining and still have like some meat of a story to tell. So Mercy's this kind of like classic devil chick character that we've seen in fiction before, especially comic books, but she actually lives on Earth disguised as a human and works for Heaven. So her job working for Heaven is to be this sort of unexpected bounty hunter hunting down their rogue angel problem. So Heaven has a problem with angels just sort of going off the grid all the time and for various purposes, some more nefarious than others, and she's like this agent they have hiding out here on Earth to take care of it. The story's gotten a lot more, you know, evolved and stuff than that, but that was the gist of how it started.
And how long have you been doing the character?
Way longer than makes any sense for how many issues there are. There should be a lot more out. We put it out in 2008, so what was soon to be like the worst time in the economic history. Got that first issue, and it had started as a doodle at a convention a couple years before that, and was really just the thing, like, what would just be fun? Like, if I'm going to really spend time building out my own character, you know, it's going to have this hot devil chick in it, it's going to be punk rock, it's going to be have monsters in it, it's going to have action. It can kind of have an indie feel sometimes when I want, or it can just have big fantastical fights with angels and demons. And this character in the middle of it just drinks and smokes too much and is, you know, sarcastic and funny. And it's, We put out like a one-shot 99-cent special, and it did pretty well. That's what a lot of people got introduced to it that way, and it was just short enough to get their attention, and people liked it. Got really good reviews. So when we put out a four-issue miniseries, I don't know. I think that was in 2009, and then late 2008. Then was ready to do the next series. First, it's always been hard for me to work on my own stuff. So the big irony is I spent all this time writing and drawing first and then later writing to get into comic books. Ever since I've been professionally established in comics, I've never consistently written and drawn my own series since doing G.I. Joe. And never done my own creation. And it's just, there's so many moving pieces in the business. It's really hard. It's like impossible to draw. People used to get upset with Todd McFarlane back in the day for never drawing Spawn. I totally get it. You might be doodling and drawing behind the scenes to explain concepts and all that, but that just takes your focus. You have to do that. You know, when you're doing that's your day right there. Writing is faster, and you can jump off and write, you know, a whole issue a lot faster than you can draw one if you're in the flow. But that's still challenging too when you're running the business, because one little thing can just like stress you out, or just if you get pissed off about something or you get stressed out, all of a sudden, boom, you can't write. It just knocks you right out of that zone, and you have to like, you know, wait around to get back into it. So it was kind of already hard to get that book out, but then I did have the artist who's still on the book today, Matt Murhoff. He's been there since day one, and he's just been growing and kicking ass with it, and he's always been there ready to draw it when we call him. It was Free Comic Book Day 2009. We put out the preview of what was going to be the next miniseries. So that was the widest exposure the book had ever had, and then never got that first issue out. So kind of really left people hanging. And, you know, it's sold, you know, the book's sold a few thousand copies. It wasn't anything stellar. It wasn't quite as much as Hack Slash was doing at the time, you know, and it was just like, that book was already at a break-even, and I could do all the looking back in hindsight and seeing where it would be now if we had just continued to put it out, but it was really tough to get it out. And we had these other books selling a lot more, so it just always took a back seat. Then when I relaunched the company a few years ago, I didn't really have any intentions. I always liked that book, and I would have loved to have brought it back. I didn't get asked about anything more than that. People were constantly asking whether it was fans at conventions or on Twitter or in interviews, when is Mercy Sparks coming back? So, you know, that kind of had me really delving into, like, online, you know, how many people had talked about it back then and decided, you know what, we're going to do it. And we were doing things with Kickstarter, so that really was, like, the perfect way to say, okay, if people want this back, let's see if they'll support it. And they did, and then the first issue did, you know, really well through Diamond. Really picked right back up where it left off before, a little bit of a bump. And so it showed the fan base was there, and that was kind of it. And it's just since then, since like, I think that was mid-late 2013, on like the ninth issue of the series, and issues 8 and 9 came out back to back. Issue 10 just left the printer, so we've been pretty consistent these last several months, and hoping to continue that. And now we finally have enough for an omnibus, so we finally got up to our third trade paperback collection, which means we have enough good stuff there to compile all of it together into this nice 400-page volume, and anyone can just jump right in, go on to Mercy Sparks Bender, and piss off everyone who's been following it for 7 years by reading it in one day.
I know for me, Hack Slash was one of those books that was coming out, but I really didn't kind of hook into, oh, I'm going to read this, until that omnibus came out.
Oh, yeah. Omnibus are the best thing in the world, man.
Have you found that they, after you put those out, that the monthly book will bump up in sales after that?
No. It's like, unfortunately not, and it's a pain in the ass, because it should. It just, but they sell, man. They like, it's something about it, when you have that much content to visibly like hold in your hand, it's like, okay, obviously there's something to this book, or there wouldn't be this much of it. You know, enough people like this for there to be this big fat volume. I think it's, you know, it's fun. You know, it's, they're usually around like $35, which isn't bad for all that. And you know you're going to get a big chunk of a story. And the Hack Slash, it's awesome now because they've got like 5 or 6 collections. So, I mean, it takes up half a bookshelf.
Yes, it does. And they're heavy.
And I don't think anything sells better at conventions than when you get those things. We also did the omnibus for... we didn't even talk about that, and we don't even need to get into it, but we did all of the Dungeons & Dragons comic books. We did Omnibus for Forgotten Realms, 2 volumes of that. Did the volume a Voltron Omnibus. We did a Transformers versus G.I. Joe Omnibus. G.I. Joe on the World War III Omnibus. So we had a lot of success with that, so I've seen how those things sell, and it seemed to be the one book when we had them, and they were hot, you can never bring enough to a convention. Whatever you ship there, you'd blow through. And so hopefully, you know, now we're doing it with a Kickstarter campaign, offering a lot of cool side rewards for it, and, you know, seeing if just, not just the people who've already bought it, I don't know how many of them are going to come in, because they've got everything, you know, some of them will come back and support it even more, which is awesome. But, I think we're really going to pick up a lot of new people finally who've heard about the book, but you know, it's in all fairness, it's been a pain in the ass to get a hold of, and, or people, a lot of people have caught up with Comixology. They've picked up the digital issues, but they don't have any print collections. This is going to be a nice print collection for them. And then we'll have it, and we'll have it, in stock and inventory, and we can get it into the comic shops.
Now, what are some of the rewards you would get for this? So, you know, just go through the tiers on a high level so that people, when they hear this, they can go, hey, I want that.
Yeah, I'll actually send you the preview link. We're going to launch tomorrow. I just got the video finally this afternoon, so that's ready to
okay.
go. That doesn't help our listeners, but I'll send you the link real quick.
Well, we will have it in the show notes. And we'll also put it up on all the different websites we have.
We've got the usuals, you know, the books will be signed. Well, we're going to put these little prints inside the books, like they call them book plates, and we're going to sign those. Those are a lot easier for us to ship around, so I can get it to Los Angeles where Matt Murhoff can sign it. The colorist Greg and Fake will sign it here in Chicago. I'll sign them all. And then we'll have, we have some prints. We have, a bunch of badass prints, shirts. We're gonna do. I still have a bunch of blank copies of issue number 1. The best thing we ever did was printing a ton of those. So, me or Matt, whoever they pick, are gonna do commission sketches on those. I had this idea that I thought was hilarious. We'll see if people like it or not. But drawing actually Sharpie marker sketches on blank whiskey flasks.
Mercy Sparks is a fun idea.
Mercy Sparks is a pretty raging drinker in this series. She doesn't have to deal with human consequences of destroying her liver. We had some CGC books. And we had the really cool – these are the coolest things ever. They're really – there's very few of them, so it's not really as big of a item as it looks like it would be. But we have these killer jackets that this designer made here in Chicago. They're all in girl sizes, but instead of Hell's Angels, it's Heaven's Devils, and has the Mercy Sparks like Angel Jolly Roger symbol on it. So we'll see if those those go. They're definitely a cool thing to have on there. And, you know, if anybody wants to really go big and do a variant cover or set up a store signing, we've got that in there too. That's pretty much it. Like, we try to keep them pretty simple. I could talk all day about crowdfunding. I think it's one of the most amazing things that's happened for any creative industry and a lot of tech industries and stuff too. There's just a way, you know, you don't want to get too overboard and crazy with it. Keep it simple and offer cool stuff and don't do it, you know, don't do the same project too often and your fans will keep coming back and you really get to know the kind of people that are buying your stuff and reading your books. You get to know the demographics better, where they live. It just really puts you in a better touch with who's following you and who likes your stuff.
And one of the things that I see as I look through the stuff is you have a lot of related merchandise, which I think a lot of small publishers have lost that idea over the years of if someone likes a book and they're a fan of something, they want more. They want the shot glass. They want the t-shirt. They want the tchotchkes. I knew people who worked at Chaos, and they said that there were times when the lunch boxes and the buttons and stuff was what made it possible for them to publish the comics.
Oh, yeah.
Because they could sell tons of that stuff. So when the comics would dip a little bit, they would have that to kind of have a regular income coming in every month.
For sure. There's never been anything like Chaos before. It was a very unique, like, just phenomenon. And actually, I just talked to Brian not long ago. I'll see him in Phoenix, Brian Polito. He's back. He's just crushing it on Kickstarter right now, and he's relaunching his company that way. We talk a lot because he actually looked at kind of how I brought Devil's Due back using that, and but it's kind of like the student has become the master.
Yeah.
He's just crushing it. I say that very facetiously, but you know, but no, he did give us some props. Yeah. You know, that's what's so cool about it is, you know, it takes a lot of people to make a book successful through the store. So, you know, you could be selling 10,000 copies a month and doing like, okay. You know, because by the time you sell it a wholesale and it gets shipped around, then if you want to produce some merchandise, you know, you can put it on your website and people can find it there, but you've got to do a minimum run. It costs money. You don't really make any money off of it. When you do a crowdfunding campaign, for whatever reason, it's completely different than if you just put it on your website. You become part of something bigger and people actively plug in, and then you might have, you know, 500 hardcore fans spread out all over the world, and now you bring them to one place where they can come in. And then now, guess what? Okay, 25 of those 500 hardcore people, they do want, you know, a t-shirt, or, you know, 100 of them want a shirt. 20 of them want a goofy shot glass, you know. And as long as you go to somewhere that you can get those minimums at a decent price and you charge the right price, you're good. All of a sudden you can do that, and you do that a couple times a year, and now that property is actually, it's successful. And I'd say that what happens though, a lot of people get caught up in wanting to have this stuff. They want to do all the cool merchandise and everything. That's the other side of it. People create all these rewards for no reason, and they don't actually build in a real profit margin on it. So you have to be very careful about how you set up those campaigns. You know, it's like, okay, what's it going to cost to print this book? There's a minimum print run for that. There's a minimum price for that. Then if that's your goal, then every copy of the book you sell, great. That's going towards that goal. Every t-shirt you sell, every like other little, you know, tchotchke thing that you sell, that is not going toward that goal unless you've built in a profit margin. So if it costs you $5, you should be selling it for $10, you know. Yep. Otherwise, And then, okay, now that extra $5 is going towards making the book. Otherwise, you're just, you know, it's vanity. And that's okay to do the vanity project too, if you know what you're getting into. And then they don't, you know, that's where all the stories come in, where they don't factor in the shipping or the international shipping and all that stuff. So, but it's worked great for us. And I don't know, I literally brought this entire company back utilizing this technology, and I have no intentions of scaling it back just because we're back in the stores now. I mean, this is the future. It's not something that you do because, you know, it doesn't make you look bad because you need to ask for the money or something like this mentality people have. This is the way things are going. And there's actually a whole other levels of this. Like the crowdsourcing is how loans are going to be done. It's how equity fundraising is going to be done for IPOs. It's if the government ever gets out of the way of that, which it has to at some point because there's just too much momentum. Like, I haven't felt more strongly about seeing trends like that. Since I was telling people like 80s stuff's going to be big. And everything that we planned it's taken a while and it goes in baby steps. But if I look back at the roadmap I set in place 2012, 2013, it's following right along that path. Like the way that crowdfunding has grown tremendously. And now it's something that people are way more open to that would not have been open to it at all a couple of years ago. And fortunately, we're still the only publisher who is actively embracing this and weaving it in with a traditional publishing model. Everyone else is just saying they're either a creator who's publishing their own thing or they're somebody who is – or someone or a publisher says, hey, if you go put that on Kickstarter and it does well, then I'll publish it. Well, of course you will.
One of the other things you talk about on the website is you do have this three-pronged approach of the crowdsourcing, the comic shops, and the digital. And one of the things I've always been curious about, one of the reasons I like the omnibuses and the digital, I've been collecting comics since I was 11. That's a lot of stuff, just stuff.
Oh my God, yeah.
Needs space and needs storage and needs taken care of. And I'm not a pristine mint Mylar baggy guy. I want to read the comic guy. So has digital moved along with the other things? Is it lagging behind? Is it ahead? Does it hit a different audience?
Ironically, it just makes people want to buy more shit to keep in their house.
So I'm weird.
Yeah, like,
'cause I don't do that.
I'm really, really, I'm a really disappointing nerd when someone comes to my house because I do not collect stuff. Like I did, and I've had boxes of stuff, and like right now it kills me that I have like, I don't know, I got about like 10 short boxes, and those are our archives of stuff. And I'm like, and I just wish I could just do something with them. But I got like one long box of like recent last, you know, few months of stuff that I read that's not our books. But so I, you know, I thought digital was really cool, but even me, I found that like I actually would rather read the books. It's weird. The whole ebook industry kind of took that turn. Everyone was really into it and it was blowing up. I was even thinking that it could surpass, you know, I was thinking to myself, like, you know, it's up to like $100 million now. How long before it's surpassed the $700 million print comic industry? And then it just fizzled out. But it seems to, it's the ideal thing for indie books. Like, you know, the store is going to have the Marvel and DC stuff. But if you like a book like Mercy Sparks, then you might find issue one at the store, issue two at the store, then you can't get three. And then you ask the store to order four, it's too late, it's on back order. You know, they're like, well, we can get issue five for you. And then you're like, well, shit, you know, I gotta read those. Digital solved that problem. Like, boom, they can go there, they can read it, and they can pick right back up and collect. They can try stuff out for $1.99, 99 cents. I think it was a huge mistake the industry charged $1.99. I think Steve Jobs figured it out. 99 cents was the magic price. And I think we would have so many more people reading digital comics right now for 99 cents. I think it would just
agree.
I really think it'd be like 10 times more people reading, but it has to be an industry-wide accepted practice. When the big publishers balked and were charging, and I get it, you know, like Marvel's trying to charge. Marvel can't come out with 99. Well, I think they could have actually. I think it would have helped stories, but I get why they're worried about retailers wanting to crucify them if they charge 99 cents for $4 books on the digital versions. But at some point, everyone pretty much decided $1.99 is the magic price. And then I saw a drastic shift. Like, it didn't matter if you charged 99 cents or $1.99. Everyone was just ready. They just assumed that's what it cost. And so digital is nothing to like write home about as far as sales, as far as money coming in. But it is part of the equation, and we include that on, you know, our crowdfunding campaigns too for backers. I look at it like I don't care how people want to read it. It's not my job to tell people how they should collect or read their stuff. I don't collect variant covers. I don't, you know, but I make some variant covers because I know people like to collect them. We try to do, you know, some kick-ass variants. I don't put my comics in plastic bags, you know, but we do some CGC stuff. And then, you know, if you want to just download it and read it, fine. If you want to subscribe to the book through your pull box, it's there. You give people need to just give options. The customers need to be given whatever option they want right now. There's no room for a company, I think, to be picky about how they how their customers are consuming their content. That's up to the customer.
And you've talked about how you brought Devil's Due kind of back from the dead, which, to me, that's kind of an amazing story. And now you're bringing now you're bringing in First Comics, and my first question is, I was a huge First fanboy in the 80s, and you're going to be publishing The Badger, one of my favorite comics from the 80s. How much of that is going to be kind of that feeling that First Comics have had, and are you going to try and get back some of those books and some of those creators?
Largely that responsibility really comes down to Ken Levin, who's the owner of First, one of the original co-founders, and his main editor, Alex Wald, who Alex actually worked for the company way back in the day as well.
Yep.
They're really the ones that spearheaded that. Ken's the one, well, Alex largely too. They have the relationships with all those creators from back then. But they also, you know, that relaunch isn't just really first and foremost. They know it's going to be about the classic stuff. Everyone wants the classic stuff. It's already going to be assumed that that's what they are. So there's been a big effort to make sure that they have a lot of new content ready to go. So like 80% of the stuff is new. Well, I mean, it's all new, but like 80% of the stuff is completely new properties and new stories. But and then there's some new continuations of the classic books. And then there are a few reprints here and there. And was really surprised. I was not surprised. I was happy to see, because I believed it, but until you actually see it happen, you're not sure how people are going to respond to, you know, wanting to come back and pick up these retro titles and be glad to see this retro brand back. So if I hadn't believed in it, I wouldn't have done we wouldn't have done that merger. But once we finally announced it, the amount of people who have come back and said like, oh my God, First Comics is back. That's awesome. It's been great. And, Badger, I don't think I've been asked about anything more than Badger. So it's I'm at more conventions than Ken is, so whether I have anything to do with Badger or not, I'm going to be asked about it 5 times an hour. So I made sure to let him know that that was the book. Out of all the titles they had, all the new stuff, I was really a big advocate to push public relations. I thought that was like right on the nose for what is kind of like the vibe of the best indie comics right now, what people are resonating with. That's like Princess Bride meets The Office. It's a great title. Really funny book. And Badger undoubtedly is just something that, you know, it's Mike Baron doing what he does. Like Badger's, everyone knows Badger is just crazy. I tell younger people that Badger is basically Deadpool before Deadpool, but even crazier. And that's actually coming out in February. And then there's, you know, like there's some of the reprint stuff. Like, I gotta say, one that surprised me was one of the best selling trade paperbacks that we released, on the first comic side was E-Man, recollection of E-Man. It's like a $28 book, not a cheap trade paperback, but it's not an omnibus either. And that thing got like, just kept getting reorders. So, and that's a book that you look at that, it's such an innocent kind of looking 80s, you know, vibe to that whole series. Even though it's not totally for kids, but it just, that one really spoke as like, okay, here's the demand for the classic material. And then another book coming up that I'm excited to see first putting out is Delete, which is from Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray, and Amanda Connor's doing the cover for that. It's kind of a Minority Report thing in the future where the government has authority to basically get a hold of your memories. So we don't quite know what's going on after the first issue, but you know, there's a murder. Some people were involved in some stuff, obviously in their past, that's catching up to them, and their daughter gets caught up in it. And the only person that can help their daughter survive is this sort of a simpleton guy who's, I don't know if he's like the janitor or the handyman in the building, or he just lives in this apartment building with them. And he just knows that he has to help protect this girl now, and he's way in over his head because he's in over his head just walking down the street on an average day. So he's not quite like Hodor, but he's not the smartest guy in the world. So,
okay.
It's like take that Arya Hodor, or no, that's Arya in the Mountain, but like take the Hodor with one of the kids walking around in Game of Thrones. He's not quite that out there. You know, he's a little smarter than Hodor, but now put that in the world of Minority Report. That's kind of what we've got there.
That sounds like fun stuff. It really sounds like fun stuff.
Really good sci-fi, and the art is phenomenal. Amanda's doing the covers, but this guy, I'm blanking out on names. Timms, his last name is Timms. He's going to do some Harley Quinn stuff too. The guy is phenomenal, and super energetic, action-packed stuff. So really good sci-fi. I'm excited to see that one. They spent the last 3 years putting books together. There's like 20 projects ready to go. There's like 20 more in the works. Public relations has over a dozen issues already done before the first issue even came out.
And what I like is it's new ideas. It's not, oh, here's another superhero book. Here's another this. One of the things that drew me to First in the 80s, if you look at their lineup, and then you look at what Marvel and DC were doing, it was completely different. You know, there was nothing like American Flag. There was nothing like Badger. There was nothing like Nexus. Yeah, they had hard science fiction. They had just off-the-wall stuff. Grimjack, probably one of the most innovative books at the time. And it's good to see that they're going to come back and try to do that same thing, where it's, we're going to go at 90 degrees from what everybody else is doing, because why do what everybody else is doing?
Absolutely, and that's why we fit well together. There's so much good stuff out there now, it's hard to be completely different than everybody else because there's a lot of different stuff. But the one thing that just kind of organically happened with the Devils Due lineup is no one book was like the other. Mercy Sparks was completely different than anything else we did. Squarriors is just really intense, you know, political intrigue and warring clans and post-apocalyptic, you know, amazing artwork. And, you know, then we've got The Tales of Mr. Ree, which is this very subdued psychological horror that really like sticks with you. And then Plume is like a fantastical Western with a whole magical element to it. But there's no, like, all these titles we did. Solitary is our one superhero title, but it was a superhero prison drama. No book was anything like the others. And that's what I'd really been curating and building up over the last few years. And the first lineup is really the same way. I mean, there's nothing about it that's like a house style or a specific genre that they cater to. It's really across the board. They were even able to take a little even more risks than I was. So there's some books that they've got a lot more like kid-friendly stuff. They've got some books that are really kind of like really way out there. The kind of stuff that I would have enjoyed but might have been afraid to publish. They went ahead and they have that. So it's all finding its way out. Part of it, too, is not putting out too much content at once. We're already releasing a lot of books in a short amount of time. And that's been the goal was, you know, to try to stick to releasing a new issue, number one, of some kind of a mini series or a series each month and keep adding to that each month and then add a new graphic novel every month. So so that after 6 months comes by, you have all these different series at various stages of issues and you've had a handful of graphic novels come out and people see like that it's growing. Cause the one thing that everyone has seen over time, especially retailers, is that there's been a lot of people come out of nowhere, put out a ton of books in 1 month, and then, you know, spend millions of dollars and they're gone.
Yeah.
And there's actually been a lot of new companies like that pop up very recently that's kind of like happening all over again. So we wanted to just not take a super long time to start putting a lot of books out, but just, hey, okay, we're here. Whether you're paying attention to us or not, we're going to promote the shit out of this everywhere. But, you know, we know that no matter what we do, you're going to be inundated with all these other companies too. But you'll hear about us. You'll see, oh, wait, there's a first book. Now there's two or three first books. Now, okay, oh, Devil's Due and First have like six books out this week. And now that's happening. So it kind of like just slowly builds up in people's minds until they realize, oh, crap, you know, they have all this stuff coming out and it's awesome. So that's the goal anyway.
And I do like that business plan because when I work comics retail, one of the things that you would dread is, oh, here's a new company. It's their first month. There's eight books. And back in the 90s, it was, and they're all interconnected. You know, now at least they're not all interconnected, but it's still, it's here's this company and they're going to drop, you know, four, six, eight books on the market their first month. And as a retailer, you go, I don't want to put that much money into an unproven property. But as you build slowly over time, you also build up a reputation. And I think the reputation that Devils Due has gotten has been that they put out more of the sort of quirky books that find an audience rather than just being dropped in the market and hope they swim.
Yeah.
And like, I love your booth at Fall Con and Spring Con. You guys are always very energetic. You're excited. And one of the things I tell creators when they come to our convention or any other convention is you got to be selling your stuff. You got to be out there going, my comic is the best comic and I'm going to tell you why.
You got to give good con.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's really it's funny because conventions are they're fun. I love them. I totally understand why half the creators out there just don't want anything to do with them when they get burnt out. But I could just do them forever, and then I'm just like, oh, I got to go back and actually make comics. But the it's so crazy now that, and I, honestly, like, you're gonna see our company continue to evolve that way. At least the Devil's Due side of it. The conventions are such a part of it now. The best thing I ever did was toured last year to about 40 cities. I did a 40-city tour, 6 or 7 different conventions. I did signings at every one of those cities. I did signings at retail shops, and I did a whole pop-up, you know. And it looks really cool. When you're in there doing it, it is not glamorous. It's like...
No! It's work. It's a job.
Some shops, you'd have 2 people show up. I mean, there'd be like nobody there because you're trying to fit a whole tour in, and you can't wait just to do signings on Wednesdays. So, you know, if it, hey, I'm in this city on a Monday or a Tuesday, I'm going to be there. And sometimes it'd be great. Sometimes, like I said, there'd be like a couple people. But you were in the store. You spent that time with the retailer. They almost always buy stuff. We give them such a good discount, wholesale, direct, that they can't pass it up. So we get a presence in the store. Collectively, people are seeing online that you are doing this and that you're all these different places. Other stores in the area see that. Then they see your stuff in the catalog again. Like, that really, I really want to do more of that. And I would do that 6 months out of the year if I could. And we're doing the conventions are like that, you know, they're a lot of work. But at the end of the day, you know, you are sitting there just like, you know, hustling your wares. And really, man, there's no, that SpringCon show is so good because it's the perfect sweet spot of conventions, that we do really well at. Like, there's, the show has a history, so it's been around for like 25 years or something.
Started in 1988. I was at the second or third meeting where it was being put together.
Wow.
I actually was the so-called president for till 96 when I completely burned out, which, because it has grown even more since then, it's one of those things where it's, boy, it's sure good that they have a lot of people, because back when I finally tapped out, it was 6 of us.
So did Nick Post come in after you?
Yep. Nick came in about 2 years after I left. And he, because he had the retail shop, he had the biggest shop in the Twin Cities with the Source.
He's one of the biggest shops in the country, yeah.
And he just grew it. But it was, we were growing when we started. There was this hunger for comic conventions in Minneapolis. And I remember our big thing was, we got to get over 1,000. We got to get over 1,000. Got to get over 1,000 attendance. And then once we did, the next year it was like, we're up 50% over last year. And it kept growing like that till we had to leave the hotel and go over to the fairgrounds. And it's a beast. And I think, as long as it's well run, it's going to keep getting bigger, because it's one of the few conventions that they don't have media guests. It's all comics.
Yeah, they're like, so there's over a hundred conventions now out there that, and there's actually like 200, but I mean, probably 100 that you could really consider them real conventions, which is amazing. And, a lot of them are, you know, so new that those are the shows that are going to get the casual, like, they're going to have really good attendance. They're going to do well. They're going to be their own self-supporting business model, but they are all the, you know, it's the families that watch The Walking Dead, or the mom and the dad that have taken their kids to see Marvel movies and they want to check it out. They've heard about this Comic-Con phenomenon thing and they want to come in there. And then, you know, of course they're going to get excited about the celebrities and all that. So if we're there and we're selling original content, original indie stuff, I don't care if we have like super famous comic book artists on it. It doesn't matter to them. So, you know, we have to be really careful about which shows like that we do. And then you've got, you know, the smaller shows. What's nice is a show like, you know, like, well, now MSP Comic Con was the new name for Spring Con. It's been around forever, so I know it's going to have its trained audience. It's going to have the crowd that knows, kind of like knows like what you're supposed to do when you come to a Comic Con. You need to bring this stuff to get signed. You know how the routine goes with, I go get sketches and commissions, and or I, you know, I'm going to go to this retailer, talk to so-and-so and buy stuff and say, see you later, see you next year. Those people come there and they're there to buy stuff and they're interested in actually reading comics and buying comics. Then it's big enough that it gets all the spillover. So it still gets those casual families who, out of a percentage of them, you're going to get people who actually are being introduced to this that actually like it, and they're going to get bit by the comic bug and they're going to come back next year. So that's what I like, is those ones where you get the good base of like the long-term veterans, and then you get the spillover of all the newbies. You know, that's why it's so hard about those Wizard shows, is it's just all people want celebrity autographs. Spring Con was one of the best shows that I did in 2014. It was a great show in 2015. Planet Comic Con was my best show of the whole last year, which is down in Kansas City. And that's actually a huge convention, like 50,000 people or I don't know if it's that much. I don't know if it's that much yet, but it was pretty damn big. And it was laid out like San Diego Comic-Con, just smaller, you know, but it was like one hall straight down. And you know, and like they got variant covers from us. Like they bought covers. We had the official Comic-Con covers for it. They really promoted us well, took care of us, and, you know, it worked out for them. We were like the only publisher giving them a big publisher presence, and they had some celebrities in the back, and they've been around for 20 years or something like that, and so we had that really good crowd coming in. And after that, Cincinnati Comic Expo was my best show of the year. Planet Comic Con was the winner until that just beat it out. And that's a pretty recent show. It's only a few years old. But Andrew Satterfield's really built that up. It looks on the surface first more like an entertainment celebrity show, but he's really made an effort to get real comic book guests in and to do things that attract the actual real comic book buying crowd. So there's kind of a war in Cincinnati with like all these different shows. Actually, all of Ohio has got all these shows that go on at the same time. But they just take such good care of us. We can't say no. Plus, my mom lives in Cincinnati, so.
So you get a place to stay for free.
Yeah. But yeah, so going back to the first books, there's a really good mix of like some of the classic titles, but intentionally a much larger emphasis on new material. But the kind of new books they're putting out, you really just feel like the company never went away. And you're just reading like that same diverse, weird mix of cool stuff that they had before. That's why, you know, that's why Ken, the owner, people think that First went away or just stopped publishing or something for what, you know, because they couldn't or something, but they just cashed out. You know, they got bought out by some entertainment company that wanted to be a .com in like the 90s. So we all know how that went.
Yeah.
And then the company couldn't finish paying them out what they were supposed to. So somehow Ken ended up with the rights back, but he just spent the last 20 years being an attorney, being an entertainment attorney before anybody in Hollywood cared about independent comic books. So he had all his relationships, and the way he tells the story is, you know, he does a deal for one artist, you know, I know he reps Neil Gaiman. I don't know how long that's been going on, but the some comic book artist would get an offer from some random, you know, movie studio or something, and they'd say, I don't know who to, you know, there was no William Morris agency wasn't like approaching them like they did us, you know, once the craze took off. There was no one to talk to, and you couldn't go talk to like a, you know, the divorce attorney down the street. So, and yet if you called up a Hollywood agency, you know, and said, I'm a comic book artist doing this book, they'd just hang up on you. So Ken was like the guy who was an entertainment attorney who understood comics, and referral after referral led to him representing like Mike Mignola, Neil Gaiman, Garth Ennis, Bill Willingham. I mean, all these people. So he's some, I call him the Illuminati, because he's like hiding in the shadows, like every, you know, just when you think you know all of his connections, somebody else pops up. And then I think he is the one that helped Jimmy Palmiotti and Joe Quesada put together the Marvel Events thing.
Oh, wow.
So, I mean, that's kind of like he was involved in Marvel's rebirth. And then, meanwhile, separate from that was the one that represented Neil Gaiman against Todd McFarlane for 10 years. So the it's funny that, you know, I think that inadvertently ends up connecting to Angela being at Marvel with Joe Quesada's publishing. It's like all that stuff ties together. So it's like a big tentacle octopus just wrapping its arms around the world.
Well, and the rumor at the time, back in the 80s, was that First was kind of put together partially as a comic book company, but also partially as a lawsuit where they were going to go after Marvel for antitrust. And I never read where that was verified, but that was one of the rumors that went around with, you know, retailers and distributors, because back in the 80s, there were tons of distributors.
Yeah, that was so... What's funny is, like, because I got into the industry, I started, you know, as a weird teenager, and so I'm, like, 14 studying comic book distribution. But the, this all happened right before, you know, before all that stuff. So, like, I didn't know this until very recently, until, like, starting to work with Ken. They went, there's a lot of confusion about books, like, because I even wonder, like, okay, how much hyperbole is this that we say? Because, you know, we were – he had – in our press releases, you know, he had written in there that First was, like, the first company, the first true independent comic book company to go toe-to-toe at Marvel and DC, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm, you know, thinking about, like, all these other comic book companies that put out books like – I might misspeak here, so please no one hold me to all those details. But, like, Grimjack and – Nexus, and there are a lot of books that First published that First didn't originally publish, and it was because they were produced by like Capital City Comics.
Yep.
Which
Pacific.
Which were owned that. So what happened was the distributors started publishing their own books, and immediately got backlash, kind of as a conflict of interest thing. So they shut those down. So I'm probably not saying that completely accurately, but that's the kind of the gist of how some of that went down. Meanwhile, Marvel, Ken, some balls, Ken fucking, sued Marvel, for antitrust. And you know who one of his key witnesses was? Steve Jeppy.
That would not surprise me.
So, He says to this day he has no idea why Steve agreed to do it. There was nothing that Steve had to gain from it, and Steve had everything to lose from it if it went the wrong way.
Well, another thing to remember, he was a publisher. Steve Jeppy published books.
Yeah.
He had the Disney license for a while.
Yeah, good point. Yeah.
So, yeah, the early 80s was kind of odd. You had Pacific, which, if I remember right, they were a distribution. They started publishing. They spun off the publishing. Eclipse did not have distribution of their own, but Cap Cities did. But First was kind of the first one that grabbed the big-name talent from Marvel and DC and put out their books monthly. Because Pacific was putting out books, but they couldn't get anything out on time. You know, they had Jack Kirby.
Yeah, there was kind of a, like, it's funny. Oh, I always think about the Richard Branson story when they tried to launch Virgin Airlines. They called it a like a dirty words campaign or something. I forget what it was called. It was an awesome British term. Like, British Airways tried to slam, you know, make people concerned that Virgin was going to be an unstable airline and stuff. And they actually got in trouble for it because they were for slander and or libel. Marvel and DC really tried to put out a whisper campaign, you know, of you can't trust First Comics, you know, these guys, you know, these books aren't going to come out on time, et cetera, et cetera. So they were really, really gung-ho about all the books coming out, having a lot of books done before they were released, making sure they stayed on point.
Not to get too deep into comics history, Marvel's entire business plan since Martin Goodman started them in the 30s was, okay, if there are other publishers, we're going to flood the market and drive them off the stands. You know, in the 50s, it was, oh, horror books are big. EC's got their 3 horror books. We're going to put out 20 a month. Romance books are big. We're going to put out 20 a month. In the 70s, when Goodman started Atlas Seaboard, what did Marvel do? They doubled their output by flooding the market with reprints. And in the 80s, the direct market started. Marvel went to their playbook. All right, we're going to flood the market. We're going to put out reprints. We're going to put out this. We're going to put out all of these books and just try and flood First off the stands. But because First was putting out stuff that was aimed at an older reader and Marvel was skewing younger, they were able to kind of surf that wave and survive.
Yeah, and they did for like 12 years, I think, before they finally cashed out. It's almost funny, if anything, if they hadn't gotten bought by this other .com company, I would be surprised if Marvel finally gave in and bought them. Which is, you know, that's what happened with, I guess Marvel lost that strategy for a while, because then companies like Malibu came out and they just bought them.
I know a lot of the insider stuff on Malibu. They bought Malibu for the coloring process.
Oh yeah, I know.
And
really, really bad, but at the time, revolutionary coloring technology.
And the comics just came along.
I forgot about Prime, but that was a really good time. I had this weird, just fascination with Norm Breyfogle art. I loved it. I still do. I still look at those old Batman things, and I'm just like, it's simple, but it's so cool in some way. It's very unique.
Then, yes.
Man, I was so bummed about Rune getting canceled. I remember loving that title, and I felt like Barry Windsor-Smith was going to, like, open it up to some really cool, mysterious stuff that he had in the backstory, and just nothing ever happened, and they ruined it.
And in a lot of ways, they tried with the Ultraverse. I forget their version of the Avengers, but if you were to put that book out now with the creative team, by the way, here's a superhero comic by Warren Ellis and George Perez.
Yeah.
Okay, that thing's gonna sell.
Yeah.
I don't care if nobody knows the characters, that thing's gonna sell. But, you know, it was during a time when the market was flooded and people were leaving comics, and if it wasn't, even, you know, Marvel was canceling stuff that had been around forever because nothing sold.
Well, and you could put this in there if you want to, but that seems to be the general flow of what's happening now. The retailers are complaining about is just everything being flooded. And
yes,
but there's just so many indie books coming out now, and so many of them are doing well that it's just sort of like fizzled out. They can't keep up with that strategy of flooding the market, and now it's backfired where Marvel intended to flood the market and now their books are all late. So it seems like every time that happens, or like when DC did New 52, a lot of people have jumped ship and moved over to the indie books. But also what's happening, too, is a lot of new people are coming in the stores. So here's an interesting tidbit. I talked to Milton Greep about this. I love all the new data, you know, that they release on that they work with, was it Rob Salkowitz, I think, on Eventbrite and figuring out who's going to Comic-Cons and who's coming into the market. The Comic-Cons now, it doesn't all translate into the stores, but Comic-Cons specifically are 50-50 male-female. And then that was the first data that was released like over a year ago. And then a couple of months ago, they released the updated, you know, info that trend continued, but they broke it down more. If all of these new people coming in are male-female, and the ratio is currently 50-50, there's something that shows that, and this wasn't spelled out. I like saw this, and I can't remember what to refer to now. Like 65%, somewhere around there, of all of the new audience is female. Like it's an overwhelming majority of the new readers, because the old guys didn't go away. So, you know, they're still there. They're still going to the conventions. They're buying. And if, you know, and those, we know that those are almost all dudes. So out of the new audience, if it's a 50-50 part, you know, parity, most of the new readers are women. So that, you know, we're just seeing that really hit the tipping point now with all these new books that are coming out that would have never done well a few years ago that are just crushing it right now. You know, like Jim and the Holograms, like Paper Girls, and like the new Batgirl book and the Black Canary title, all these different kinds of series, you know, so much of the stuff that Image is putting out. Hopefully, you know, a lot of the books we're putting out, I think, you know, 40 to 50% of the Mercy Sparks readers are female. I'm really excited about it, and it shows how times are changing. Because girls, here's the thing that they told us about in like 10 years ago when the bookstores were really aggressively trying to get into the comic book business, when they all of a sudden fell in love with graphic novels after manga had started making them so much money. The bookstores always told us that women buy far more books than men do. And,
correct.
And I was remember thinking back then, like, huh, so if we ever get like 50-50 male-female readers, that means it's going to be like 75% female sales, 25% male sales. And that's – it's going to like hit everyone. All of a sudden, they're going to dominate the market. And so we're not there in stores yet, but there sure as hell are a lot more girls going to comic shops than there have ever been before. And we are already there. We're already more than 50% at the conventions. So the kind of content that people are releasing and everything is it's really good to be producing a lot of diverse stuff.
I was going to say the other thing that I've noticed looking at sales, as long as I have, is comics now have a much longer tail. If you look at the sales figures from 10, 15 years ago, the number 300 selling comic was maybe selling 1,000 copies. You look at that chart now, and yes, I know that the chart is extrapolated and the numbers aren't exact, and but if you look at that bottom number, that bottom number 300 selling comics hovering around 4,000 copies.
That hit me like a lightning bolt just a few months ago, because
so that means yes, you're not going to get, you know, your top comics are selling 100,000 and it drops off fast. But look at that large number of books; it's just kind of staying at that break-even point or just above, and they're building inventory, they're building trade paperbacks, they're building a back stock, and those are people who would never buy a Spider-Man comic in their life. You know, the people who are buying Saga aren't going to be buying Captain America.
And that was not the case for a while. Like, that actually has really come in to help the industry, because I noticed that, you know, a long time ago that, oh, the bottom numbers are getting higher. The first time I noticed is when I, you know, would think that, oh, man, we're going to have this book in the top 300. And then I'm like, damn, the top 300 is higher again. But that was good for the industry. So I had it in my head that, you know, traditionally it's been about 3,000 copies. So for some interview or something, I was like looking back. I was like, you know what, I'm going to go back and actually look at the charts. I was going to make some claim, you know, because we were usually around like the top 7 publisher in the industry. In the mid 2000s, we were almost always in the top 10, but, so I went back to look at that and I just got sucked down the rabbit hole of looking at all the stats and everything. And there were publishers I completely forgot about. Like Viz was always in the top 10. There was some weird Wizard sometimes was like some weird offshoot was in the top 10.
They had comics for a while.
Yeah. Like Boom was never around. Dynamite was kind of there, and then you saw them starting to creep up. But there was this was like 2002 or something, 2003. I looked, and the top 300 book was like 800 copies.
Yeah,
I was like, holy shit! Like the book, you know. So I'm thinking about all of those years where you would see them really concerned, probably. I don't know, I'm guessing like 2007, 2006 through until like just a couple years ago. Oh, you know, they'd always comment the top 10 books, only 4 books above 100,000, only 2 books above 100,000. Everything else is lower, you know, kind of talking about, hey, we should all kind of look at that and poop our pants a little bit.
Yeah.
And it never changed. But all of a sudden the bottom started to change, and it's been like a, you know, from the bottom up, and, you know, no better example of that than The Walking Dead starting at a few thousand copies and working its way up all the way to, what it is now. So that stuff really excites me. And, you know, I really have no interest or like passion about building up the company, worrying about any traditional model from the past. I don't care where we're selling our books, who we're selling them to, as long as they're reaching an audience and we're making money that allows us to continue to making more books. So, you know, we have books that do great on our highest grossing title that we've done in the last few years that's raised more money than anything, if you factor in all the stuff, is, you know, Scorriers is really there, like our breakout hit, but it's been Plume. I mean, that we've done phenomenally well with that on Kickstarter. You know, it does not move a lot through the stores, but we have sold through the stores. But it's just that it's based off of a webcomic book that has a huge fan base, over 1 million hits a month, and hundreds of those people come out to support it. But then we got titles like Scorriers, which was new to the world, came from nothing. So the Kickstarter campaign did really impressively well for being brand new. And then it's just kicked ass in the comic book stores. We've got variant covers with a lot of people as well, like Midtown Comics, which is as big as it gets, the Phantom Guys, Rupp's Comics, the, you know, this is only like a 4-issue miniseries we have so far. So we're about to follow up with a sequel to that. The trade paperback's on the way to stores, and Mercy just continues to build its backlist. It's like the poster child for that now. our books like are scattered all over the place with how and where they actually support themselves. And I'm just really fascinated by how we've been able to do that and where I see that going in the future. And it's more and more, it's weird to say this as a publisher, but I said this a couple of years ago and I still believe, like, traditional publishers are kind of obsolete. I mean, there's the creator more and more has to face this dilemma of, I have more resources to put my own stuff out now. I can, if I have a fan, if I have any kind of a following, I can, you know, totally just put this out, support myself. But they also, they don't know there's a lot of stuff that they need to do. So I've really been looking at, like, what is, as publishers, you know, have to start to deal more with creators having more options and not being the gatekeepers anymore. We haven't been the gatekeepers for a long time, but to the customers, you know, like, what obstacles still remain, and kind of flipping it, like, what obstacles still remain that are keeping creators from wanting to produce their own stuff and becoming the kind of publisher that really just actually says, you know what, we're going to embrace that and we're going to give you what you need to even have more power. It'll be a while before I can articulate that completely, but that's kind of where I see comics kind of catching up to, you know, how music has played out and how, you know, so many other industries have, creative industries have played out. Like TV having this rebirth with success with Netflix and, you know, bypassing the whole studio system and bands starting to figure out how to be really successful again without worrying about the old label model. Comic books is a much more difficult industry to figure out, and it's not even you can't even compare it to the ebook publishing, because the whole art component that goes into it and the whole fan following and the weird lifestyle culture that embraces it, it's totally different than anything else. We're our own weird, beautiful, nerdy little pimply industry. And and also, it's also an industry that's really good at chewing people up and spitting them out. So we don't like tourists. You got to be a lifer.
So I want to thank you for coming on. We've got two episodes out of this. So, and the Kickstarter, the notes will be in the show notes. We'll have links up on the Facebook page and every place else. I want to thank you for taking so much time with me, Josh.
Thanks for having me.
And good luck. Good luck on this. Yeah.
Must have been fun. It went on for a couple hours and didn't realize it, so
oh, yeah.
Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Again, I want to thank Josh for coming on the show. That was he was very generous with his time. He was getting ready to go to the Phoenix Fan Fest, which is a very different kind of convention. It's in this football stadium, and it's not just comic book people, but it's sports people, and it's huge. I've heard that it's just huge. Josh will be at both. He'll be at SpringCon in the spring. You know SpringCon, the one that Joe pushes on every episode. Speaking of pushing stuff, here are advertisers. Solitaire Rose Radio, episode 47. Interview with Devil's Due publisher, creator, writer, Josh Blaylock, part 2. In this second episode, Josh gets into more about Mercy Sparks, which was the Kickstarter he came on to promote. I am not one of those people who feels that someone promoting something in an interview is something bad. When I watch The Tonight Show or Stephen Colbert's show or any other talk show, the reason people go on is they're there to promote something. That's why you go on these shows. I would love if every interview I ever heard anywhere was someone just coming on because they wanted to chat, but that's not the way the world works. People come on because they have something to promote, and when I look for interviews, a lot of the people I have on are people who are either promoting something or someone I know who has a very interesting story. Josh had something to promote. We have a really good conversation. We find out more in this episode, not just about Mercy Sparks, but how his company does their marketing. We dig into First Publishing, because Devil's Due has partnered with First Publishing. We find out about their history
and why they have come back. There's a lot of information about comic conventions and marketing at conventions. One of the things I really liked about this conversation was that Josh got into what it takes to sell comics. And it's one of the things that, because of all the retail work I've done in the comic book field, I've always had that in my mind that you can't just drop your books on the market and hope that they get picked up. You got to market, you got to go out, you got to shake hands. And Josh is really good at that. I first met him at one of our conventions, either a fall con or a spring con. I don't remember which one because it was quite a while ago. And I was not really into the licensed books that he sold, but he was so engaging and such a good seller that I picked up some of the other stuff they did. He talks about how the marketplace is changing and how he is moving his company in ways to pick up on those winds of change, to kind of sail on them. There's a lot of information here, a lot of good discussion. I really like this episode, and I hope you will too. That was a whole lot of podcasts this week. We had 4 podcasts this week, and because I have to listen to them and do the editing and cut things together and put in the openings and the conclusions and everything, I'm really kind of tired of my own voice. But if you're a comic creator and you've got something that you want to push, or you just want to be on the show, go ahead and email me at solitairerosenetwork@gmail.com. If you know a creator, you know, let's say you're listening and, oh yeah, I've met thus and such, and I think they'd be a good guest, go ahead, email me their information and I'll contact them. We're looking to do Solitaire Rose Radio a little more often. Next week, believe it or not, we only have 2 podcasts. We've got the Crazy Comics and Stories, where we actually get into the writer versus artist debate that's going on again. And then on Thursday, because it's every other Thursday, is the next episode of Novelcast. We are nearing the end of my first novel. We have passed the halfway point, which has started to make me a little nervous that I really need to get to work editing the next novel that's going to be in Novelcast. One of the things I like about Novelcast is that I have kind of put myself in a position where I have to write and edit in order to have content, because I have promised every other week a new episode. So I've put the pressure on myself. We're also coming up to the end of the year, which means, for one thing, we have the Festivus episode. Go ahead, send me your Festivus grievances. Use the email address, use any of that stuff. Just email me your Festivus grievances. We would love you to be a part of the show. And the second thing with the end of the year is we're starting to look at what we're doing next year. The Solitaire Rose Network has grown this year. We have done more podcasts this year than any other year in the past. We have joined YouTube. I looked out there earlier today. We've got a couple of the YouTube podcasts that I've got a couple that have done over 100 views. I've got some that have done a large number of views. And one of the things I've noticed is that people really, really like, for Solitaire Rose, they like the EC stuff and they like the Kirby stuff. The Kirby stuff is nearly done. There's one more Kirby episode, but the EC stuff I'm going to focus on a lot next year, which means I get to read a lot of EC comics. And I can say it's for the podcast, but really it's because I really like reading a lot of EC comics. If there are topics that you would like me to discuss, I've had a few people send me some topics that I'm mulling, go ahead, use that email address, and we'll be back very soon with more stories.